You are listening to the Wells Tech Podcast, where we talk about technology that can serve the church and its work of spreading the gospel. Wells Tech is a part of the Podcast Network on Streams, the internet media site sponsored by the Wisconsin Evangelical Lutheran Synod. Join the conversation by visiting our podcast website at wellstech.wells.net. You're listening to the Wells Tech Podcast for Wednesday, January 27th, 2010. This is episode 116, Photography in the Classroom. Welcome again to the Wells Tech Podcast. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And we're so happy that you've decided to spend a little more time with us. This is the 116th time we've gathered. I'm Martin Spriggs, Wells Chief Technology Officer, and your host, one of your hosts for the Wells Tech Podcast. Joining me, as usual, is Sally Draper. Good morning, Sally.
Good morning, Martin. Happy to join you this morning. Happy the sun is shining in Sleepy Eye after some 60-mile-an-hour wind gust yesterday.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, throw we had some horizontal snow.
Gets the wind chills down there nice and low, too.
Yeah.
And we're not alone, Sally. It's not just you two, you and I just rattling around in the Wells Tech Podcast. We have back with us our semi-regular classroom technology correspondent, Gail Potratz. Good morning, Gail.
Hi, Martin and Sally. Good morning.
We have not had you on since, I think, last October. How have you been?
I've been great. I guess I missed the last month. I was in actually over by Sally in Mankato. Yeah,
you had some family things.
Care of a brand new grandbaby.
Yeah. You got this thing called school you have to deal with too once in a while.
That's right.
So you've been keeping busy. I know that you've been keeping up on technology, see your tweets, and you're a regular contributor to the show, even if you're not with us in voice. So that's good. And you're going to be a big-time contributor today because we're talking classroom technology and specifically photography in the classroom. We're going to run the conversation a little bit different this morning as we had an interview that we're going to play right away and then react to and then talk a little bit more about this photography in the classroom concept. Pete and Carrie Schlosser were good enough to spend some time with us and shared some, I think, some fairly innovative ways to introduce the camera and its many uses into the classroom, especially in the elementary grades. Pete is a professor at UW Stout, and Carrie is a, I forget whether she was, what grade she was teaching. Do you remember, Sally? I'm going to put you on the spot.
I think she's preschool.
Preschool at up near Menominee, Wisconsin. So let's play that interview, and then we'll come back and do a little bit more chatting about photography in the classroom. Joining us today on the Wells Tech Podcast is Pete and Carrie Schlosser from, I'm just going to say, Northern Wisconsin. They're both members at St. Paul's in Menominee, Wisconsin. Father, daughter, I assume, right, Pete, Carrie?
Yes.
Right.
Okay. Thank you very much for joining us. You had presented at the Wisconsin State Teachers Conference a few months back on the topic of photography in the classroom. Thought it would be great to talk to you about what was presented there. We have a number of teachers that listen, and again, thank you for joining us. Maybe we could start by having each of you tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, I'll start. I'm Carrie Schlosser. Right now, I'm currently teaching third grade in the Barron Area School District. I'm in an outlying school called Almena, and I have been using photography at home, at school, for the last 2 years teaching. We use a lot in the classroom to document what we're doing and also just to have fun with it, to let the kids be a part of that and explore that photography bit, share it with their families and their friends. Mm-hmm. I also coach the cheer and dance team for the high school, so I'm pretty busy with that after school. And just do drive back to see my parents quite a bit, okay. So I'm lucky to be only about an hour away.
Very good.
Pete? And I'm Pete Schlosser, and I'm an assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin-Stout, and I teach photography and graphic communications, and my research area is instructional technology.
Very good. Yeah, it sounds like both of you have some good, very practical experience, which is kind of what we're after. So at this conference, I noticed that you were presenting at least one workshop on what was called photography in the classroom. Maybe walk us backwards. How did your interest in this area develop, specifically photography in the classroom?
As I mentioned, I teach photography classes at Stout, and my research area is media technology, instructional technology. And when I was looking for a research area for my dissertation, for my PhD, I arrived at, well, what better than using photography in the classroom as a communications tool, as part of technology for teaching? And then, because of the area I teach in, I have to aim at adults, but I started getting interested in some of the lower grades. And Carrie, being an elementary school teacher, we decided that we would kind of pursue that, let her kind of run a parallel to my research. And there's some interesting comparisons that have happened there. And then, somewhat by chance, I started developing a book, and the thought of a book, and then Carrie picked up on it using photography in the elementary classroom. And we have presented the draft a couple times, and one of the Wells teachers attended a workshop at Stout and saw that and had asked some questions and kind of led from there. But I'll let Carrie talk a little bit more about how she's incorporated it just kind of as a natural thing in her classroom, apart from her experience at home.
Mm-hmm. I also have a degree in early childhood special education, too. And I feel that with all the hands-on activities that I like to do in my classroom, it's really hard to document sometimes the activities that the children do. So I've found that it's so easy to take a picture of a project they're working on or small manipulatives that different students are working with that I can document what their work was that day. So I do use photography a lot with documentation of projects, math, science, writing. A lot of times the students use the chalkboard to write or the whiteboards, and they can't keep it. So I just take a picture and I put it in their file on my computer, and I'm able to bring those up later on and see, you know, how their work was that day, what they did, see the progress from the beginning of the year to the end of the year. It's just something nice to have to also show my supervisors and our principals what we're doing in the classroom too, because sometimes they're looking for those hard document copies of what the children are doing. But in my classroom, and with the needs that I have in my classroom, a lot of it is hands-on. Mm-hmm. And I know a lot of teachers do a lot of creative hands-on things with clay, with beads, with small manipulatives, some of those wiki sticks, which are sticks that are just a wax that you can bend and manipulate. So I know a lot of teachers do use it, and it's hard to document without those photos. So mm-hmm. I do use it for that. I came about the project, too, also for my PDP plan, which is my professional development plan. And I know some teachers do have to do that now. It's a 5-year plan before we get our regular teaching license.
Mm-hmm.
So my plan is to use photography in the classroom for documentation. So that's kind of where I jumped on this idea right away. I thought, you know, I can do two things. I can use it in my classroom to benefit the children, and then I can also use it for my PDP plan to finish that. So it worked out really nicely that my dad had some hookups with the photography area.
Okay.
So I had a lot of help there.
So did you have any prior experience with photography before your dad started his PhD work, or is this brand new to you then?
No, not brand new. I've actually grown up with him as a photographer.
Okay.
She was born into a photography household. I was a photographer for 7 years before she was born. And
okay.
So we've had a professional studio, and she's helped with weddings and senior pictures. And that's what she's known.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but I would have to say the last couple of years, I've just kind of picked up the technical things of the cameras and what each mode can be used for. So, you know, I did know how to pick up a camera and use it before, but I've got to say in the last couple of years, I've learned a lot just by exploring the camera myself.
Mm-hmm.
Playing with the different settings and stuff. So,
So guys, when I was looking over the description of your breakout session at the teachers conference, it said that you were going to give innovative ideas and projects, and I just love to get new ideas for use in the classroom. So I'm wondering if you could share some specific project-oriented things that maybe the students could be involved in with photography.
Sure. Last year, I did a photo gallery, actually. It was during one of our spring shows. We had a fundraiser, and all the children were given the opportunity to take my little digital cameras, and they took pictures themselves. They took about five, and then we narrowed those five pictures down to one, and they had to print it and have a photo gallery. So I've done that because I know some schools do science fairs and, you know, book fairs where they have people come in, and we've done that. One we did today, actually, in the classroom was my dad took pictures of their faces. Then he took the eyes and the nose and the mouths from everybody and mixed them. So if you could make a flip book with everyone's eyes, nose, and mouths, too. So they could take the eyes from Julie and the nose from Destin and the mouth from Tiffany and put together kind of a funny face.
We kept the kids engaged and guessing. And
oh, I bet they would have loved that, huh?
Yeah, they started to figure out how similar some of their faces are, and they're like, some of the kids didn't even know themselves.
Yeah,
right. It was funny.
I've also used their smiles for the beginning of the year. I like the kids to get to know each other, so one thing I'll do is just take a picture of their smile, and I'll put it in a flip book with their face, too, so you just flip it up to see who it really is. And that's a fun circle activity to do, and then later on to put it in your library, too. Hmm.
One of the activities that Carrie's been having her students do that I think is really neat, it's a literacy thing where the kids are third grade classroom, they're journaling, one is the journal reporter and one is the journal photographer. And so throughout the day they have different activities in the school and they become the official photographers for the other classrooms too, which is kind of neat.
Mm-hmm. So birthdays in other rooms, a guest speaker. One, my photographer will go in and take a picture along with the journalist, and the journalist will write a small paragraph of what was going on, and then we can upload it to the classroom website or the school website. So it's kind of fun for them to be involved in the community in a little way.
But it gets them thinking about being reporters and being observant and really getting the kids engaged, and the photography just becomes a natural part. I think to start with, they kind of fight over the camera, but then pretty soon it's just something they do.
Mm-hmm. I do let them actually take a lot of pictures of the work that they do because they're very proud of their work and they want to show people. They want to show their parents. They want to show the teachers next door. So a lot of times when I use little beads for math projects such as multiplication, putting them in rows, I do let them take the picture, and then sometimes they do get to print it either black and white or color, and they can take those home and show their parents or show their grandparents what they've been working on at mm-hmm. school.
So what are some of the ways that you've integrated this concept of photography? I assume it's not a photography class that you teach, but it sounds like you're integrating it with the curriculum. What would be some of the, you know, some of the class subjects that lend themselves very well to this? You mentioned taking pictures of projects, but are there other ways that it could be integrated in other areas?
Yes. In science, we had this really great project the other day where the kids were looking for things that were transparent, translucent, and opaque. And they went around the room with their flashlights, and they were looking. Well, you know, it would have been hard for me to remember what we have in all school science programs. So they're split up, mixed into groups, and we rotate. It's going to be hard for me to remember 65, 70 kids mm-hmm. if they understood that concept. So what I did is when they found something that was transparent, I took a picture of them shining their light on the object that was transparent. So then I can look back at these pictures. And mm-hmm. I mean, they can have these pictures to take home and have fun with, but sure. I'm also able to document that they knew the difference between transparent, translucent, opaque.
Very
so do use it in science all the time. Mm-hmm. Sequencing a plant growing, so mm-hmm. from when we plant it
yeah.
to a few days later to when the plant is grown to when the plant dies. I do have scientists that take pictures of those whole sequences on the lifespan of that. We've done insects outside, taking pictures of going around the gym looking for ants, bugs, you know, things to take pictures of, different topics.
Sure.
Also like soil, sand, rocks, different ways heat can travel through water, things that travel faster through cold water, through warm water. We did a project with food coloring, and food coloring travels faster through warm water, and then we had the cold water sitting right next to it. Well, I was able to take a picture and stop that image for them so they could grasp the idea that the food coloring in the cold water was going really slow.
Mm-hmm.
But the one in the warm water just dispersed right away, and it was blue. So we were able to do a writing project on that with that picture. I use it a lot in math, actually, because I do a lot of things with multiplication right now in shapes. So they're able to make shapes with pattern blocks. Also, multiplication, like I said, putting them three beads in a row, five rows, so 3 times 5. And then what they do is they just write on a piece of paper or one of the whiteboards right next to it what the answer would be, and we would take the picture of it.
Interesting.
So kind of using it. I have done geometry in the community. So we go around and look for all those geometry shapes around the community, and that is so much fun. Stop signs, fences, gardens, trees, you know, whatever they could find that was a geometry shape. And then we brought them all back and we labeled all of the geometry shapes from town. That's always kind of a fun one to do.
Mm-hmm.
I do use it a lot in writing because I know some students do better when they stand, so I let them write on the board for their stories, or some students use different whiteboards or chalkboards, or they just use one of my small pens that goes on a different kind of a paper that we have. I do take a picture of that so that I can keep it and so they can keep it too to turn in. So you can kind of document the way that they are using their mm-hmm. writing, their letters and things on work.
So, Carrie, you're kind of hinting at my next question, which is reaching out to those students that maybe aren't engaged in the traditional methods in the classroom. And have you had successes with engaging learners who are struggling using photography?
Definitely. My actual PDP is going to be on, my professional development plan is going to be on engaging students with photography. And it does work. You can have any student in the classroom who really doesn't like to write or really doesn't like to read, but you get your camera out and you take a picture of them reading and they'll read for hours. And especially for doing work too. I mean, you get that camera out and they're able to take pictures of their friends, even if it's just quietly one or two photos at a time, which I do. It works. Those kids will work as hard as they can work to get their picture taken. And I usually have a rule where you can't look at the photographer when they're taking it. So it needs to be a secret. You're never going to know if they're actually taking a picture of you. So you work hard all the time just in case that camera takes your picture. But they do. They love to show their work. Mm-hmm. And I have seen an increase from the beginning of the year last year to right now. I've seen the increase in my students just working harder and harder and harder. And as soon as I put that photography in the classroom, they wanted to do this and that and more math, more science, more reading, and I just thought it was great.
Wonderful.
So
if there were a teacher just interested in this and maybe wanting to try it out, what would be some suggestions either from an equipment perspective or even a procedural or process perspective?
One of the things that a lot of people are afraid of engaging in this project because they think the kids are going to ham and it's going to be disruptive, and I pop into Carrie's classroom periodically, and the kids don't really know me until they've been there a time or two.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really not disruptive because what I'll do is I'll put the camera down as soon as they start paying attention. They have to learn to ignore me.
Okay.
And that helps them learn to ignore distractions among themselves, too. But I've been amazed at how fast. All I've got to do is put the camera down and say, I'm not taking a picture until you pretend I'm not here, and then they'll go back to what they're doing. But some of the projects to get the kids engaged, sometimes I think is talking about picture books and how they can create these things.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not beyond the reach of these children. The art project, and that's a standard one if you start an art project, but the interesting thing with the art project is let the kids do what they want to do without too much direction because they're very creative and their view is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to overcoach the kids with a camera.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We've found that sometimes the simplest things like an ant or a piece of grass, we would never get down on our knees to take a picture of something like that, usually. But here these kids find the simplest things in the world to be so interesting and so cool. So I found that really, really kind of fun to think back about all the simple things in life and not to overlook them. So that's what the kids have kind of helped me do in the last couple of years.
Sure. So I would assume that any kind of point-and-shoot camera is going to work?
I was going to say, I have taken a couple old cameras that I don't use anymore, and those are the ones that the students use with, like, a lanyard around it. I always hook something onto it because they have to wear it around their neck or their wrist.
Uh-huh.
It's dropping-wise. I do the neck. And they can't, you know, take it off until it's in the other person's hand. Otherwise, I use a different camera, but I don't usually let the kids use that one. So if people are using their personal cameras, they'd either want to hold on to the camera with the students, or the students can direct it. If they just want to start using photography to engage students, all they have to use is their simple point and shoot, and they could say, students, you know, keep working while I take some photos, and those kids are going to love it. Because they're going to love to see themselves on the photo when you print it off.
Right.
Putting the cameras into the hands of the kids, a lot of people are intimidated by that, and they said, well, I can't teach the kids how to run these cameras. And more often than not, you don't have to. You put it in their hand, and they figure it out really fast.
You tell them how to turn it on and how to push button.
And a very cheap resource for cameras, quite honestly, the digital cameras have been out long enough that just about every family has one on a shelf at home that they don't use.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been amazing how many people are willing to either send one to the classroom or send it with their kid daily.
Mm-hmm.
One of Terry's kids in class today had a camera that she carries with her all the time. Last year I noticed a little girl that had a camera all the time.
I believe it was a $15 camera from Walmart or Kmart.
Yeah, it was like a little Barbie digital camera.
Mm-hmm. And it works just fine, and it has a plug-in, and I'm able to pull the pictures off right away for her.
Cool.
So otherwise, I've just asked people to donate their old cameras that they don't use anymore,
mm-hmm.
and you would be amazed how many people would just say, sure, use this for the school.
They don't have to be high quality for what the kids are doing.
Nope.
Very nice. So tell us a little bit about the book you mentioned before. What's its purpose, and you know, what could we expect when we would open up the cover and take a look through it?
Well, what I thought would be great to do with my professional development plan is actually to create an artifact at the end that I could show. So I was hoping to put together a whole bunch of activities for teachers, because I know that for me, I can think of the activity, but, well, you know, there's so many other activities out there. So I wanted to put a whole book of ideas together. And inside that book, it has different things like skills you can work on, different cognitive skills, large motor, fine motor skills, and I have them all written there. So if you wanted to write a lesson plan on it, you would have all the details you needed to write that lesson plan.
Mm-hmm.
It also has just maybe a few ideas to make it harder, or also to make it a little bit easier for some students to grasp, depending on what grade level. I've done a lot of different things where the one activity, such as my alphabet book, can be done from kindergarten on up, preschool on up. In the preschool area, the students would be given a camera, and they have to go find a picture of something that begins with the letter A. So they would go around school looking for something that begins with an A, and they would take a picture of it. So they're just looking for those pictures. Later on, the activity would be a little harder for first, second grade, where they're actually writing the word, or they're sounding out the word and they're trying to spell it. In third grade, what I do is they take the picture, they spell the word correctly, and then they also write a definition of what they think it is. So I have the same activity,
mm-hmm.
but in the book I have different levels of what you could do for different grade levels.
That sounds like a great resource. What's the, you have any idea when the publishing date would be?
We're hoping for spring, summer next year.
Okay.
We've got a deadline. We're doing another workshop on our campus for the
okay.
childhood teachers in April, and we've kind of got a self-imposed deadline that we'd like to get it in the hand of the publisher before May.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, that's exciting.
We do at the early childhood conference at UW-Stout in April.
Mm-hmm.
That'll be our next speaking day.
And we're doing a workshop.
We're doing a workshop where we're actually teaching the teachers how to change and edit photos and let the kids take that photo from the camera, put it in the computer, and then manipulate it and make crazy faces or just take their face off, change faces. So.
Mm-hmm. Very nice. Well, Carrie and Pete, so much appreciate that you took the time to spend some time walking us through this. I think it's an extremely valuable resource. I'm sure the folks who attended your workshop down at WSCO in Milwaukee got a lot out of it, and we're looking forward to the release of that book. Please let us know so that we can promote that on the podcast, and maybe we'll have you back on after the book, and we can talk a little bit more. Exciting topic.
We did enjoy the presentation down there, actually, most of the people who came there gave us a lot of ideas, too. So
awesome.
It was a really good workshop. Yep.
Very good.
A nice interchange, and it's really returning to the roots of almost, I always refer to it as caveman technology. We're going back to visual literacy.
Yes. Yeah. That's a thought I had, yeah. Again, thanks so much for taking the time. Blessings on your work and your ministries.
Thank you
very much.
When we started that interview, Sally and Gail, I really didn't anticipate the direction that it was going to go, where there are just some almost common sense uses for just a plain old camera in the classroom, and it really seems to enliven the educational experience.
Yes.
Right. I think it's kind of like any technology that you introduce, the children are really intrigued by it, and it's really neat to hear Carrie's stories about how excited they get about the camera in the classroom. Mm-hmm.
Right, and she used it in a very practical way to enhance the showcasing of their work, which is important to them, but also important to the parents and others in their life that need to see their progress and want to see their progress.
Yeah, and not a hard thing to do. Any teacher could do this, and as they mentioned, any old camera, and many have these digital cameras that are, you know, second and third generations now, so they've got the first gen camera just sitting there, probably not being as productive as it could be, and, you know, great uses for this. And if it, getting it in the hands of children, you know they're going to get roughed up and damaged or whatever. So there are some good uses for those older cameras. And I'm excited to see Carrie's book when that comes out, and we'll certainly update everybody when that is available. So let's talk a little bit more about uses of photography in the classroom. There's lots, obviously, of online resources for this kind of topic, but both of you have a little bit of experience there as well, right?
Yes, I'd say I have a little bit. Mm-hmm. Definitely not a professional photographer.
Right.
Very interested in hearing the way Carrie spoke about photography. I was envisioning even not only still cameras, but using the video camera mm-hmm. to record student, like an experiment, something you want to see live.
Sure.
You know, making use of the video camera in that same way.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the still cameras go, I happen to have a partner that I teach with in the eighth grade here by the name of Drew Cuck, and he is a very talented young man, and photography is a hobby of his. So one of the things we do in our class, no thanks to me, but to him, is he has the kids take an oatmeal box and make a pinhole camera.
Mm-hmm.
So they actually learn how a camera works. And he's wondering now if that's still valid, considering the cameras that most of the kids use don't work that way anymore.
Right.
But learn how the original camera was meant to work. They go out and they take pictures inside and out with their own cameras that they've made, and then they go through the development process. And we actually get some, you know, black and white images that look, we can recognize them, let's put it that way. So it's just lots of fun. The kids love doing it, and I think there is some value in the hands-on learning, you know, how the camera works and even the idea of what a negative is. So that's one of the fun things that we do. And the other thing that I have really done just this year, started to introduce more and more photography into the classroom, into a particular project we're doing, a year-long project we're doing to honor the Vietnam veterans from our community that lost their lives in that war. We have a monument in our park to these 13 people. And so we're doing some research on them. And so at the beginning of the year, when it was not horizontal snowing outside, we took a walk down to the local park, and everybody brought a camera. So we were going to take pictures at that park of the memorial and whatnot. But before we left, we had a couple lessons on how to take a picture. And then on the way, there was a landmark that was being destroyed in New London that we took pictures of. We did a lot of picture taking and learning on the way that day. We probably spent about 2 hours of taking pictures. And before we did that, I introduced the kids to a couple sites on the internet that are very good for learning, for kids or adults, some very basic photo tips. What makes a good picture? Not only how do you take it, how do you compose the picture? Where should the subject be? How to frame the subject? Those things that all really contribute to a better looking picture when you're done, if you just take a little time to learn them. So I'd like to mention a couple sites that are very good for doing that, to learn photo tips and techniques. And I know Sally has them in the show notes. One of them is the Kodak Top 10 Tips for Taking Pictures. And that is just excellent. They have the top 10 tips, and you click on them, and they explain what they mean by getting down to your level when you're taking a picture of a dog, for instance. I think that's the example they use there. How the picture is much more, it's a much nicer picture if you're on the level rather than standing up above looking down at the dog, you know, that type of thing. Things that are really not too complicated, but most people don't pay attention to them. Where, you know, we point and shoot and we don't think about those things, and you can really improve your photography in a lot of little ways by looking at these 10 top tips.
Yep.
Great links for us to share with our listeners, Gail, and thanks for your contribution there. It's neat. You also shared with us a link to your very own Flickr set that has images where you're demonstrating those top 10 tips. So we want to include that in the show notes as well.
I did a thing with that Flickr set. I think those are the pictures that, those aren't all my pictures. Some are, but some are the kids' pictures that they've taken. And I collect them periodically and I put them in a set, and then kids go out there and they look at the pictures and they go, oh, she used going with the direction, or she, oh man, what, Mrs. Potratz, why didn't you use this? Cause I throw some bad ones in there too sometimes. So it's just a good way for, and I take a lot of bad ones. It's a good
way. I was going to say that wouldn't be hard to find in my portfolio either.
It's a really good way for kids to look at a set of pictures and talk about those tips. And you know how easy it is to build a set of pictures on Flickr or Picasa or any one of those sites. So that's a neat way to put into practice and share your own work as it relates to the tips.
Very good. For us here in Sleepy Eye, we've kind of focused on the back end of images photography by having some image editing software at our fingertips. So, for instance, I've given the kids activities to go around school and take pictures of different letters of the alphabet so that they could do a mashup image with a lot of different letters from different font sizes and things like that. So they've had fun on the photography side of it, searching out the letters they need to spell different words or whatever. But then we've also done a lot of exploration on picnic.com. That's PICNIK.com, which is a really fun image editing website. And you can work with Picnic for free. The kids can upload up to 5 images without having an account. But I actually went through the process of setting up accounts for each of them on Picnic using my Gmail address, the little Gmail extension trick, my Gmail address with a plus sign and another alias after it, so that they each have their own logins, but all of the email associated with that gets directed to my account. And so they're able to log in, have I think up to 100 images stored on Picnic that they can manipulate and edit to their heart's desire, and they've really enjoyed that side of the photography lesson as well.
Great. Yeah, that's always something that's important, because once you get these pictures, if you're going to use them, of course, the very first thing is even the basic, how am I going to resize this? Because anything you want to use these photos in, when they come off the camera, of course, they're very large. So good to have those places.
Great. Again, thanks to Pete and Carrie for taking the time to share some interesting ideas, and both you and Sally Gale for the same. Some of our listeners from way back may have remembered that we interviewed an actual photographer, Lori Ashbrenner, who gave us some nice tips on equipment. So those of you that are interested in getting into more realistic shots and learn a little bit more about lenses and camera bodies, those kinds of things. That interview with Lori was very informative, and we'll post a link in the show notes to that. So hope everybody enjoyed that conversation. Let's roll through our mind map. We're down now to about 4 o'clock on the map, and that is ministry resource time. Sally, we ran across a nice resource over the course of the week we want to share.
Actually, Pastor Guy Marquardt out at Christ in Lodi, California, ran across this resource and added it to his delicious feed with the tag Wells Tech. And so we were able to pick up on that, Martin. And it is to a Greek-Latin audio recording website. And actually, it has a little bit of Hebrew on there as well. So what this person has done is put together MP3 files of the entire New Testament in both Greek and Latin. And he's even got Genesis and Jonah from the Old Testament done in Hebrew. So you can download these MP3s and listen to them. I tried. It was Greek to me. Sorry. but they do work. I gave it the old test run, and I was able to listen to some Greek this morning. You can download them, or you can order a DVD with the entire collection on it if you'd prefer not to go through the download times. But for those of you that are into that kind of thing, here's some audio recordings that may be of interest for you.
Interesting. I think that just as kind of an item of interest, that might be something to play, you know, during a Bible class or something like that, to hear it in the original language. I know that my Greek reading skills are a little bit rusty, so I think I would probably even benefit from hearing somebody actually read it right.
Yeah, this guy that does the reading is very fluent. It was very smooth and easy to listen to.
Very good. So we'll put a link to that in the show notes. On to news and news in tech.
News in tech. And I don't know about you, but this was popping up all over things that I read. Big news for me, at least, from Google Reader. Google Reader is my preferred RSS reader, and they announced this week that you can subscribe to any web page using Google Reader. In the past, you needed a valid RSS feed in order to subscribe to for updates to websites with Google Reader. But now you can actually just type in any web address in the subscribe box, and if no RSS feed is found, Google will basically scrape the page on a regular basis and create a feed for you in your reader software. And I just think this is really powerful. For me personally, there's a couple of websites that I just regularly have to manually check, and it's outside the norm now to have to do that because I rely so heavily on RSS feeds. But one of them is our Wells Tech Wiki discussion board page. And sometimes things pop up on that discussion board page, and unless I go and look, I'm just not aware of it. There's no notification process on that page automatically. And so having that in my Google Reader is going to be a real benefit to me. And so maybe there are pages out there that our listeners are manually checking on a regular basis because no RSS feed exists. And here's a solution for you.
Awesome. Google Reader, those that have listened to the show in the past know that Sally and I both are big fans of Google Reader. Sally, Gail, what do you use for RSS feeds?
I also use Google Reader.
Okay.
Yes, yep. I do. I was just thinking as you were talking about it, I have way more in there than I can keep up with now. So I don't know if I need to have more websites that don't have the real feed.
Maybe you need a little house cleaning, I'm thinking.
Yeah, I think you're right, Martin.
clean this reader. I was just fooling around with my Outlook client the other day and found a way to get Google Reader to come up as a window in Outlook with just the click of a folder, which is really cool because then I don't have to jump out to a browser to do that. And those of you that use Outlook probably are aware that you can actually display web pages in Outlook. And since Outlook is kind of the hub of my productivity during the day, that just makes it a little, you know, it takes me one less step, you know, to get to that information. So, and they seem to keep up with Google Reader updates pretty regularly. They're adding features, and it's easier and easier to share, tag things, those kinds of things, tweet things. I find that really helpful.
You know, Martin, I'm just reminded that this past summer we did a bonus Wells Tech Goodness episode on Google Reader, dedicated to how to get started with Google Reader. So if there are listeners that aren't using Google Reader or looking for a new RSS feed solution, maybe you want to check out that episode from our archives, and I'll put a link to that in our show notes as well.
Yep, great way to stay, you know, bring the news to you. Picks of the week. Let's move right into that. Gail, you want to lead it off today?
Sure. We have talked before, although it's been quite a while ago, I think, about a site called drop.io, and that is the address of the site. And currently, drop.io had been a place where you can share documents with people, and you upload them, and they give you a little code, or you could name them yourself if you want to. And all you have to do is give people that code, and they can go in and see the document. So I had used it in the past, and it came across my attention this time because they've got a new feature. I decided to go back and look at it because of present.io, which is a new feature in drop.io. And as you might guess, it has to do with presentation. At first look, I thought, oh, well, it's another slide rocket or slide share, or, you know, there's a lot of those out there. But it's way more than that. If you go to drop.io and you get involved with presenting things, what they've done is you can upload any kind of content, pictures, documents, audio, web links. You can put anything you want in your drop, as they call them. And then you can collaborate and share that space with people. Other people can go in there and do their thing, download it or work on it, whatever. And then, you know, you can go back and get it. So you can put anything in there, collaborate in the space, and people anywhere out there that you give the drop to can go in and get it. And the thing is, what it actually turns out to be, since you can do this live, so to speak, it turns out to be you could use this like a GoToMeeting type situation. You know, everybody could be in there at the same time communicating, and they're actually kind of marketing it as that. Is it could take the place of like you could do a webinar in there. All you would have to do is have people have that that drop address and go to that address, send that out to whoever you want to have at your webinar, so to speak, and they log in, and you could go through things in this presentation, you know, live with them. So it's way more powerful than SlideShare or SlideRocket. It isn't just another one of those things. It's more, they've developed it to the point where you can buy into it. You can get the professional edition for about $50 a month. You can still do things free on there. You get your 100 megabytes free, I believe. But past that, if you want to go beyond that, they have some business plans now that you can get into this. They call it drop.io manager. And that allows you to actually keep some of the things around a little bit more easily. That's one reason I had gotten away from it is, after a while, these drops that you make just kind of sort of disappear. And I didn't like that because sometimes I don't go back and look at something for a year and then it's gone. So I had kind of gotten away from using drop.io and went to another system. But I'm going to come back and try to use this now as a in-service training tool with people. Not only people, you know, not necessarily people on site, although you could use it that way, but people that you train that aren't in your same building with you, I think you might be able to do some good in-service training this way.
So, Gail, you don't know how long the free service allows you to maintain files out there, do you?
I looked for that, and I didn't find it.
Okay.
I can search that out.
To hear if it lasts long enough for you. If you do start using it, hopefully it's going to be
right.
You know, a long enough retention period that it's useful for you.
Right. I would, you know, you would still keep your files. So anything you uploaded and made a drop out of, you would still have your original file. So even if it, you know, went down, you could create it again. You revisited, you know, create a new drop with the same material.
Very good. I'm just looking at the present.io site, and they kind of label it as real-time web presentations in two clicks, and that seems to be the theme, you know, of these kinds of Web 2.0 solutions today. Make it easy, make it quick. I just need to get in, get out, get people on there. And if it works as well as Dropio does, I think that probably got a good chance. So let us know.
Yeah, I'll let you know.
Sally?
Well, for me, I'm just going to share something homegrown with an education twist, since this is our education-focused show. Mm-hmm. I wanted to share my Twitter list of EdTech Twitter people that I follow. What do you call people on Twitter? Tweets? Whatever.
Followers?
That's better than twits, Sally.
Yeah, there you go. But I've put together the list of those, of all the people I follow, those that have education technology focus and what they're tweeting out there. So basically teachers from all over the world who are doing really exciting things in this web-based world that we're living in and applying it in their classroom. And so if you're new to Twitter, if you're a teacher, this may be a list that you want to follow. And it's fairly easy to do. I'll have the link in the show notes. But basically you go to twitter.com/WellsTechTrainer/EdTech, and my list will come up, and there'll be a button there for you to follow it if you're logged into Twitter. And then you can go to that list and just see that refined, filtered view of the tweets of those EdTech tweeters, so that you can just focus on that if you want. And basically, this is my personal learning network in the EdTech realm, at least, and has been extremely valuable to me. And I thought it might be worth sharing with our listeners in list format.
Very nice, thank you. I suppose that's up to me now. The since we're on the presentation theme, Gail started us off there. I'm going to share something that I'm just starting to use. So I don't have a lot of experience with it, which is always dangerous, called Prezi, P-R-E-Z-I. I saw a couple of tweets about this last week. I explored it maybe 2 or 3 months ago, I think, when it first came out, and didn't do much with it. So the encouragement there was to give it another shot. There was an announcement that they've got some excellent educational pricing, as in free. But Prezi is an online presentation tool. It's different than any other one. I have been using Slide Rocket for a long time, and it's kind of a slide-based model of presenting, and I think that's been a pick of the week in the past. Prezi is a very different thing. It's a large canvas concept where you throw everything on there in different sizes and shapes and functionality, and then you create a path between all of the elements. And what happens is when you play the presentation, it zooms into each of the different items that you have on the path, and there can be rotations, animations, videos. It's really a unique experience. It's like zooming in and out of a large document, and you can see it at a very grand scale or very micro scale, and the path that you take can be very intriguing to watch, and I think preserve the interest of the viewer. They have an offline player if you pay their if you pay for a more premium subscription, but there is a free component as well, which I'm trying now, and I think that gets you 200 megabytes of space, which for most things is plenty. There's all kinds of samples or showcase things that they have there. I was just looking at one called Creating a Personal Learning Network, for instance, or Google for Educators, that talks about how Google Apps for Education works. How can we measure teaching? All kinds of teacher-related resources. So I think there's probably a good component here, a good segment of teachers using this at this point. But you almost have to go to the site and see how it works. It's prezi.com. If you wanted to upgrade, it's fairly inexpensive if you're not an educator. $59 a year would get you 500 megs of space, or $159 a year would give you 2 gigs, and you get rid of some of the watermarking, you get the offline component, and you can privatize some of your prezies, as it were. So I've got a presentation coming up out in Minnesota in probably 2 weeks, 3 weeks now. I'm going to try and use this particular technology and see how it goes. There's very intriguing concept. I think it takes more work, I will say that, to build one of these, but the end result is very dynamic and very engaging. It's not just your plain old slideshow. I think you have to you think a little bit outside the box for something like this. So that's Prezi.com.
All right, Martin, you got to be a visionary, huh? Have an idea of the end goal and drill right down to it.
You got to see big picture and little picture. Have you seen it before, Sally?
Just the examples I've looked at before, but I'm definitely going to check it out for school usage. I'm not sure if we'll qualify or not, because they're asking for an email address and expecting it to be a .edu.
I think so.
Domain.
Yeah, but I think they will. I think they will. If you send them an email, I think they will. What I was reading, they will work around that.
Okay.
Or they also say that there's some apparently online ways to get an EDU email address, so which would qualify. So check out their site for that. Yeah, Prezi.
Yeah.
We've got some training coming up, Sally.
Yes, that's right. We're preparing for Final Web for Dummies, and we're going to be offering that training in Milwaukee, New Ulm, and Saginaw. So we're covering three of our Midwestern states with the training coming up on March 9th through 11th in Milwaukee at the Senate Administration Building, and in New Ulm, Minnesota at Martin Luther College, and then again on April 6th through 9th in Saginaw, Michigan at Michigan Lutheran Seminary. We've got 3 days planned, and participants can pick and choose. They can attend all 3 days or select individual days if they desire. Day one geared toward the beginner, day two intermediate, and day three advanced. You can get all the details online at bit.ly/FW4Dummies. So bit.ly/FW4Dummies. Check it out and get registered today.
Yep. We expect to have some larger numbers, so you may want to do that today. And I'm looking forward to teaching that. We have not done this in a while, and this is really going to be a whole new course, and Final Web has changed over time, and we've got 400 or 500 congregations actually using this, so we expect a good turnout.
Had a lot of response so far, and a lot of people, you know, asking, are there going to be other sessions, are there going to be other locations and things, and right now this is what we're offering, and we'll see, you know, how well it is responded to, and if there is a need, I'm sure we'll consider other sessions in the future.
And maybe other sites like Hawaii or someplace like that.
Somebody suggested Denver. Yeah. That sounds like fun.
All right, community feedback. We've got a lot of feedback today.
Yep, we love it when our listeners talk to us. And Gail, you are one of our listeners who was talking to us this week.
How about that?
How about that? Can you tell us a little bit about what you were tweeting to the Wells Tech community this week?
This is Geeky Bird. Is that the one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Geeky Bird, as geeky as the name is a very cool site. It has nothing, it actually does have something to do with the birds, because the guy really is a bird lover. But in his blog here, it has to do with the Inspiration software, United Streaming,
right.
Discovery Education's United Streaming software. And I know that our Synod still provides a consortium price on that, and many of us have and use that faithfully and enjoy the multimedia that we are able to download or to stream from that site and use within our lessons. And one thing that I'm always trying to get people to use is the assignment builder or the quiz builder. In other words, the multimedia is great, but there are some other features in there that really make this a powerful tool for you to use. And the directions for that aren't necessarily the easiest to follow on the Discovery site, I don't feel. So the Geeky Bird blog, what that does is it goes through very basic things about how to use the United Streaming product to its full advantage. And the directions are very concise, very easy to follow. I think if some people go there, they will be impressed with how much easier it is to find out how to use features there than it is if you just try to use them through the site itself. So I thought it was worth mentioning.
Very good. And you also had some experience with one of our mentions in last week's show, I think. Jason Schmidt had shared a link to Volunteer Spot, and we talked about that as a possible ministry resource last week, and you gave it a try this week and wanted to give us some feedback on that as well.
Well, I'm still working with that. Maybe I misunderstood the intention of it, but I would just like to be able to sign up a very small, like, okay, who wants to sign up for here's the greeter list for the next 3 months. It's out on the web. Go ahead and sign up for that. And I haven't been able to do that. It's more event related, and the way they use volunteers is a little bit different than the way I typically use the term. So for me, the jury's still out on that one. I'm still playing with it.
All right. Well, we'll be anxious to hear if you make it work for you there.
Okay.
Yeah. Martin, we also had some feedback from John Shoesmith. I think he was writing to you on this one.
Yep. He was looking for a way to not just have a live video stream, but have some kind of interactive component to that, where somebody could be watching the stream and then have some kind of chat window. So they were looking at Ustream, and those of you that have used Ustream know that you can build that. You can check a box, and ultimately you've got a built-in chat window, which is very easy to use. And I think all of the services have some kind of social concept like that. So Ustream is no exception. You know, Mogulus or all of those have a chat window feature, which is kind of cool. But if you wanted to control it a little bit more, you could embed your Ustream or whatever it is, your live feed, on your web page, but also add another embed through a product called Mibit, which works with the IRC framework of chat technology. IRC is a free open source kind of a chat relay system, and Mibit is a Java plugin that allows you to open up your own chat window, and people can just enter a username. They don't even need to actually do a login. Just enter who they are, say Martin or Sally or Gail, and they would come into this chat window and chat away. There's all kinds of features available within Mibit. That's Mibbit. Just do a quick search in Google for that, and you'll find out how best to do that. So that would be another suggestion as well. So I think we're going to see more and more of that, where live streaming is going to have that social component where people can watch, but also then interact with each other about how to interact with each other about what they're seeing.
Very cool. Looking at the future there, Martin, and I love it that John's leading the way. He's done a lot of cool stuff with closed caption video.
Yeah.
He wrote me recently and told me that they were eating grits up there in
Washington
State. The Wells Tech podcast has all kinds of breeds.
Get grits. Didn't know if you could get grits in Washington.
Yeah, that's exciting to know.
By the way, I just wanted to follow up on that, too. We're going to be doing a live web stream of the Lutheran Boy Pioneers convention. They have a business meeting, and they asked us to do the web streaming for that, or live web streaming for that, so people from volunteers from all across the country could join in on that instead of traveling. I think they're holding it in Watertown, Wisconsin. And they're going to do a chat component as well with this exact same technology, where they've got some of their board members and people interested in what's going on in the convention. Logging in, watching the stream, and then interacting with the convention, those that are physically in Watertown, via this same technology, via this Mibit and IRC window. So we'll have to see how that goes. That's an interesting way to engage the viewer.
Well, that's exciting. Fun to get a chance to play with that and see how it works for you.
Yep. And all free.
Very good. My favorite price.
Mm-hmm.
heard from Pastor Nate Celo. He is a teacher, a tutor out at Great Plains Lutheran High School, and he started a class wiki, and he sent us a link to it, and we checked it out, and they've got some cool stuff going on out there at Great Plains Lutheran High School. Very interesting to get to navigate through and see how he was presenting material for his religion class. He's got presentation material posted and assignments and things like that. Sent him some links to some different ideas for potentially adding more discussion topics and quizzing as well to his class wiki. So there's lots of things you can do with your students online, giving them that extra component to the materials they're receiving in your face-to-face class. And I think it's really neat that they're doing that out there.
Very nice.
Yep. Martin, I have you down for having tweeted a few other things throughout the week. Share those links with us.
Let's see. Now I have to refresh my memory. So you're going to force me to actually click on these links in the map and see what comes up. Christianity Today had a nice article, actually a very complete article on the virtual church and where that is all headed. And that's a question I think is coming up in the minds of a lot of people when we talk about live web streaming and streaming our services and sermons and so on and so forth. Where is all that headed? And they actually focus on a couple of congregations who have virtual congregations. I think many of us have heard of lifechurch.tv and a few other things. So I felt that was just an interesting article on where that started, what some of the things they are dealing with, and how maybe we can have almost a hybrid approach to that in some of our own churches. So I think there's some interesting stuff there. And the other one was maybe be on the minds of anybody who's in charge of multimedia or the audio equipment within our churches. The FCC very soon will be cracking down on illegal audio equipment because it's broadcasting on a band, 700 megahertz, that they're repurposing. They're going to be using that, I believe, for TV. And so they want any device that's broadcasting on that 700 megahertz band off. And this will affect some of our churches and schools because there were manufacturers, not the mainstream manufacturers, but some of the knockoff manufacturers that would sell some of this unlicensed equipment on the 7 megahertz band. And this only applies to wireless mics, by the way, to churches and schools. They targeted churches and schools, and churches and schools would see the low price and purchase this equipment, install it, thinking everything's great. But unbeknownst to them, they are using equipment that is now illegal in the eyes. It always has been illegal in the eyes of the SEC because it hasn't been licensed. If you've got a licensed wireless mic system that is running on 700 megahertz, your manufacturer should be able to provide you with a way to get onto a different band, some kind of firmware or upgrade that could be made available or give you different equipment. But you may want to check that out. Just check your wireless equipment, and we'll provide a link to the article there so you can see a little bit more about what the FCC is saying. And they're taking a pretty hard line, apparently, on this as well, where they're going to physically prosecute those that they find illegally on this 700 megahertz band. So very
good heads up for us. Yep. Yeah.
So you may want to check your equipment.
All right. Thanks, Martin, for that.
Sure.
Next up, we heard from Ryan Rosenthal, who teaches at Faith in Fond du Lac, Wisconsin. And he was excited to share via a tweet the fact that he found a really easy way to create student accounts on his Wiki Spaces mm-hmm. wiki. And in response to that, Jason Schmidt, who teaches out at Gethsemane in Omaha, Nebraska, tweeted right back with tons of other tricks for Wikispace wikis or wikis in general, and shared two different links, which are just a conglomeration of all kinds of ideas of things that you can do on your wiki. So I think Jason gave Ryan a great jump start, and both of them, we really appreciate them sharing these ideas with the whole community. So if you're a teacher and you're looking for a way to get started with wikis, here are some ideas from Jason and Ryan that will definitely help you out. So check those out. Jason also shared links to 10 reasons to use Digo, which is a social bookmarking tool, and it allows you to annotate the web as well, make notes, highlight things, that kind of thing. Very powerful resource. And another link to a video conferencing guide. And I think it's a great way to help you get started with video conferencing if you haven't done it in the past. And there's a basic guide, and then there's one specifically geared to teachers. And so I think you'll find those very useful as well. Thanks, Jason, for all the links that you share with us. A few links that I shared this week. One is to a Google Analytics cheat sheet. I don't know if some of our listeners may be a little bit like me, and I go to Google Analytics and get just a tad bit intimidated by all the great stuff that is available there. And this cheat sheet maybe will focus you in on some of the important things that you should be looking at in the analytics for your website if you are using Google Analytics for that.
Yeah, and we should probably, those of you that aren't familiar with analytics, it's a free tool that Google makes available. You insert a little bit of code on your web page, final web, or whatever, doesn't matter. Most websites will receive the code, and then you've just got a ton of data about who's visiting your site, where they visited, how long, where they came from, what search terms they used to get to your site. When I do my workshops, one of the feature areas is this Google Analytics site, and people are furiously scribbling down, you know, the URL and are going to go back and implement that because it makes you smarter. You're spending time and energy putting your website up. You might as well know how well it's doing.
Very good. So get smarter about Google Analytics before you dig into the stats with this cheat sheet, hopefully. Yep. Also shared a link that I came across to middle school and high school science movies, and they're done specifically in Flash for use on a smart board or interactive whiteboard. Very well done. I'm wondering if I can remember where they came from. Great Bar School, a specialist science college, and just high quality. There's physics, chemistry, biology, investigations, police systems, all kinds of things. Simple little flash movies that will be great on your interactive whiteboard. Kind of a higher level thinking involved in these, so middle school, high school level for sure.
Yeah.
And last up in our community feedback, I had an email from Bill Radinitz from Redeemer in Maple Grove, Minnesota. And Bill's congregation is using Final Web and wanting to extend their web presence to include a discussion board as well. And he was looking at using, I want to say it's PHP BB, which is PHP Bulletin Board, right, which is a free open source software that can be installed on a web server for use on your website. And just, you know, kind of asking some questions about what direction they might go to include a discussion board in their website. And one of his caveats was that he's not much of a techie.
Yeah, and then PHP BB means you need to be a techie.
Right, exactly. I think you're going to be dealing with back-end MySQL databases and all kinds of things like that. So my response is, it's hard when those kind of questions come in. And I guess one thing that kind of struck me is there hasn't been a lot of discussion on our podcast about discussion boards. Maybe that kind of technology is moving, we're moving away from that with the Twitters and the Facebooks and
the
blog comments,
right, yeah,
all that kind of stuff. You know, even Google Wave, which we haven't talked about lately, but, you know, it's more real-time and instantaneous communication than asynchronous communication. But if you are looking for a discussion board solution, rather than, you know, investing a lot of geeky time in installing and maintaining something that you know, potentially may go by the wayside if your guru leaves the congregation or loses interest or whatever, maybe you want to consider a blog. That's certainly an alternative. You know, it's not the start any kind of thread solution that a discussion is. You know, it doesn't allow the same freedom, but it does allow the comments and discussion in the comment area. Another solution I found was MinuteBoard.com, which says that you can install instant message boards and discussion forums on your site and integrate them using their free solution. And I told Bill, and I will throw it out there, that I would ask our Wells Tech podcast community if they have discussion board solutions that they can share and recommend. So there you go, community. We'd like to hear from you and hear what you're doing in terms of discussion boards if you're using them on your website.
Yeah, one would think that there's got to be a number of Web 2.0 types of cloud-based discussion boards that are available that could either be embedded or linked to, and depending on privacy, you know, needs, just to, you know, get an account and go after it. So I'd love to hear from our listeners, see what they've found. Mm-hmm. Well, that's it for community feedback, lots of it. And, well, before we go, Gail, I've got to ask you, what's the, you know, with the Viking loss last Sunday, was there joy in Packer? You're closer to Packer Town than we, that Brett Favre is not going to the Super Bowl?
Well, I think the consensus is we're happy that some other team gets to deal with all the drama for the next 3 months now. That's more important than the actual game.
Yeah, is he coming back? Isn't he? You
know, let somebody else. We'll just sit back and let somebody else deal
somebody
with that.
Somebody else can monitor the tractor watch.
I myself take a lot of heat from my 8th grade boys, especially because I am still a Brett Favre fan, and I rooted for the Vikings. So.
But he got pounded last week. And Sally, yeah, you were happy to see that, weren't you?
You know, Martin, I'm so glad you brought this up. I'm a die-in-the-wool Saints fan, have been through many, many years of suffering.
And oh, yeah, boy, I bet you are. Yeah.
We are headed to the Super Bowl, and I'm so excited. And it was such a neat experience to have a social football game because I was tweeting the whole time.
I saw that.
Responses, and it was so fun because – you know, that's when the power of reconnecting with high school buddies from 25 years ago is really, really worth it. Because I got some serious Southern connections that were very excited about the same.
And you're doing this all from the heart of Minnesota.
That's right. I think you wrote them a board. Are they going to let you stay in Minnesota?
Yeah.
They were understanding. They were gracious.
Okay. I don't think I could get away with that at my house.
Yeah,
at my house, when there's a Packer game on, it's like, kind of like Christmas. This is family time. This is Packer time. Why would anybody call us? Why would anybody? It's like our sacred time.
That's right. When I think I've told this story, when we were looking for a house here in Milwaukee, we had to work around the Packer schedule because nobody would show their house during a Packer game. So that would just be sacrilege. You know, why would anybody be looking at a house during a Packer game?
Makes perfect sense.
All right. Well, we've gone on way too. This is probably our longest podcast ever. But so if anybody is left listening, we're going to come back next week. And we've got a great interview with Pastor Don Patterson and Bill Esslinger from A Reason for Hope, which is their website. It's kind of a radio ministry that they webified. So we had a neat conversation with them and talk about some of the ins and outs of maybe starting up internet or a radio station or internet radio and some of the podcasting technology behind that. Let's close the show with the music of Michael Schrader, his song The Answer from his album The Way. Thanks everybody for sticking with us. We will talk to you next week.
Truth is calling, the life and the way to peace, and the answer is out there. If you don't need, get on your knees. When your life's full of questions, there's no love and no joy, no peace. The answer's out there. If you'd only look up to see. Oh, well, he came to the world to save every boy and girl, and he laid down his life for the sins of you and I. Well, that's Jesus Christ. Oh, well, he healed the lame and he gave the blind sight, and he justified us for paying our price. Well, that's love, baby. Find it in your hope and feel it in your faith. Live in the mercy God gave you by grace. Well, that's love, baby. But you can see it in the truth and be it in the light. Live in forgiveness for all of your life. Well, that's love, baby. The truth is calling. Life in the way to peace.
you gave your life so all mine live. Well, that's love, baby. You can find it with perfection and holy abide. Whatever grace in this you reside, you find love, baby. You can give your life to worry and work or hate. But as for me, there's just one way, and that's love.
Answer.